This October, the most important week in bluegrass returns to Chattanooga, Tennessee. Be part of IBMA World of Bluegrass October 20th through the 24th for 5 unforgettable days of live music, networking, and family fun. Join thousands of bluegrass artists and fans for the IBMA Business Conference, IBMA Bluegrass Ramble, IBMA Bluegrass Music Awards, and IBMA Bluegrass Live Festival. Get your tickets, see the lineup, and start planning your week at worldofbluegrass.org.
Hi, everyone. It's Tom Power. I'm back with a brand new and very special episode of Toy Heart, my podcast about bluegrass. It is an exclusive conversation with none other than Billy Strings that we recorded at last year's International Bluegrass Music Association Conference. If you love bluegrass as much as we do, and I assume you do, then this episode is certainly for you. Download and listen to this and all episodes of Toy Heart on the BGS Podcast Network, available wherever you get your podcasts.
We still treat, as a society, as an economy, what we do as this weird sideline blip, like side hustle thing. In reality, it is at the center of our economy, is at the center of culture, it's at the center of power, and the systems just don't match it yet. You make us as creative people more capable, give us more tools, let us act as real entrepreneurs and not infantilize us with BS tools, like we can do well.
We often define artists by their output, their records, books, movies, and the times they're on stage.
But the art is made in the quiet, the struggle, and the mundane, the hours that no one sees. I'm Michaela Ann.
And I'm Aaron Schaefer-Hayes. This is The Other 22 Hours, an exploration of the creative life, lived in the in-between. This week we're doing something a little bit different, and this will be the first installment of a series that we're calling our reissue series, in which we dig through our archive of the past 3 years and select some of our favorite conversations that we'd like to share with you anew. Even though we're highlighting a handful of conversations here, please know that we have 160 other conversations with musicians and non-musician artists alike, all of which are valuable in their own right. So if you're driving or maybe mowing your lawn, please take a second to scroll through our feed and find some other conversations that resonate with you. Additionally, you can head to our YouTube channel where we've taken every single conversation and grouped it into playlists that are curated based on topic. So if this conversation resonates with you, please know that there are lots of other conversations just like it waiting for you over there.
And today's first episode features our conversation with Yancey Strickler that we had back in October of 2025. Yancey Strickler is a writer and entrepreneur that co-founded Kickstarter, Meta Label, the Creative Independent, and now Artist Corporations.
Yeah, and you might be saying that October 2025 was not so long ago, but we chose Yancey for two reasons. One being his ethos and everything we talk about in this conversation is the nucleus of our show, in which we really explore how to create a sustainable career based on your creativity. And every one of Yancey's endeavors that Michaela just listed is geared towards doing exactly that. Additionally, in this episode, you'll hear him talk about how Artist Corporations is pushing for solid legislation in a state that is quote unquote artist friendly. And since then, they have succeeded. And just last month, in June of 2026, Colorado passed and signed into law the Colorado Artist Company Act, which creates a new type of LLC that allows creators to attract investors while legally guaranteeing they retain at least 51% ownership and total creative control over their work. As Yancey mentions here, what we have is extremely valuable, but us as independents, we don't have access to capital, and we're actually pretty great business people. So congratulations to Artist Corporations on planting a solid flag in Colorado, and please enjoy our conversation with Yancey Strickler.
Thank you so much for being willing to chat with us. When I saw your TED Talk, I'm going to admit I was ignorant of everything you've done up until this point. And then when I found even more about you, I was like, oh, this is like ideal for what we like to center in this conversation. I'd love to hear, just for our guests as well, a little bit of your background of you are a writer, but then what inspired you to want to create these other endeavors that we'd also love to hear about: Kickstarter, the Creative Independent, Bentoism, and now A-Course.
Yeah.
Thank you for the invitation. I really appreciate it. And really, my story starts with being the son of a musician. My dad is a lifelong musician. He's a folk artist in country rock bands. Didn't make it. Worked in a record store. When I was born growing up, his job was as a traveling waterbed salesman, and he would bring his guitar with him on the road. And so I grew up seeing the creative life as like a very natural thing, because my dad played all the time, band practices in our house, like very much a part of life, but also seeing how piecemeal it was. And it's like you're grateful when you have a gig or get paid in some way. Often it's just about doing it. I knew that there was a dream for that to have been his entire life that did not happen. And I was brought up playing music with him like I was supposed to make it. Where he did not, I could tell I was supposed to. And I just wasn't as talented as him as a player, but had a great, you know, huge passion for music and all of that. And I was made music, but I was more of a writer. And my path ended up being writing about it initially for Pitchfork in the late 90s, and then The Village Voice and alt weeklies all around the country, and just love discovering things, love introducing people to things, just like what I'm most passionate about. And I moved to New York to do that and had day jobs in like radio and started a tiny record label and was making zines with friends and was just always had my day job. And that had all my side gigs, which made no money, but were just, that was what was fun. And one of those came to be Kickstarter. One of those was through a new friend I'd met who had a wild idea for a platform where you could propose an idea, a creative idea, and the public could choose whether or not you were greenlit. You know, that project demanded skills I'd never had before, learning business, learning what entrepreneurship was, like a lot of growing up. But I really see like the trajectory, and even to the things I'm doing now, they start with being just what my childhood experience was and what was natural to me. And certainly through Kickstarter, saw over and over how, say, a successfully funded project would change someone's life financially, emotionally, in terms of credibility to their community of like, you're real. And as the creative practice and creative life has grown, like so many people, there's a crazy stat, 48% of Americans have an active creative practice, music, writing, or making art. Half of Americans. And the internet creates this interesting thing where you can try to make your side job your job. You can turn your hobby into money. You know, be careful what you wish for, but that path is available. And then the truth is, a lot of us are making things appreciated by lots of people that to the outside world might not appear like much, but within our communities, they're really meaningful. There's often a lot of money or support, more than you would expect, that exists just because of love and just people are appreciate. And we still treat as a society, as an economy, treat what we do as this weird sideline blip, like side hustle thing. In reality, it is at the center of our economy, is at the center of culture. It's at the center of like power, and the systems just don't match it yet. And I see in that gap an injustice, but I also see in that gap a huge potential, because I don't think that the status quo is due to any specific maliciousness. It's just like the conditions were different before. And you make us as creative people, whatever our practice, make us more capable, give us more tools, let us act as real entrepreneurs and not infantilize us with BS tools. Like, we can do well. I feel like I have an appreciation of where we are and where a lot of us as creative people find ourselves. And I just have such a confidence that what we do is worthwhile, that we're hugely appreciated by many people, and that we can build on that into a more economic, sustainable existence. I didn't know that's what my life would be about, but that's turned out to be what it's about. And yeah, I'm grateful for it.
One thing that really attracted me to your work and your viewpoints on all of this is that there's this weird dissonance between the public perception of what, you know, and I'll just use the music industry as an example of like a successful musician. You know, you think of like Taylor Swift, Beyonce, Elvis, all of these people that have millions of dollars. And so people are like, oh, they don't need help. Those people don't need help. The vast majority, 98% of musicians are blue collar, you could consider. Like you said, there is no system in place. It's basically like turning to some kind of beverage company. And it's like, once you're Coca-Cola, then we'll help you. But until then, good luck. Maybe get a day job.
It's funny, even for people at, say, the Beyonce level, Taylor Swift has done specific things, but like royalties are a thank goodness for anyone who gets them. You know, they're an ongoing income revenue stream that is so critical. But like, if you look at, say, Hypnosis or BlackRock or these private equity firms that have been buying songwriting credits, they view songwriting as like an intellectual property, like gold or something that they can put on their balance sheet, they could put in their financial models, they can borrow money against it, they can capitalize that because they exist in a system that that's how they see things. That same opportunity is actually not available to the artists themselves, the people who make the work. Platforms can turn the value of art into stock that they sell and use to make more money on. Same with publishers or record companies. Same with these investors buying things now. Literally everyone in this situation is able to access capitalism using this creative work, with the exception of the artist. Even for someone at the level of Beyoncé, your royalties are just like an income stream that passes in, versus as a, if you look at a corporation, like you can use that as an asset that you can capitalize, that you can raise money again. Like there's all sorts of things that you can do. There's just a mismatch of how we understand what that is, to where a financial party is allowed to view one way, but the actual producer of the work is not. And a lot of that, as I really started to think about this, comes down to, as boring as it sounds, corporate structure, where these companies exist as C corporations, which is an entity that allows you to issue shares and exist on the stock market and take in money from capital markets. Not things I'd ever think I would talk about, by the way, before the weird turns my career took. But like companies can do that. As an artist, there is no such mechanic. Through this artist corporation site, more than 3,000 people have filled out this long form about what their situation is. And half of the people who've written in have no structure at all, no corporate entity, which to me just means it's a side business and they're probably making less than 10 grand a year or something, and it's fine. For the people who have an entity, which is about half of those people, about 40% are an LLC. And then the rest is like rounding error between lots of different types of forms. And as an LLC, it's a legal shield. It's a basic financial instrument that's pretty flexible, but it's complicated to set up, not easy to administer, doesn't have ownership the way you do in other sorts of instances. And like raising money, doing things like that, that normal businesses do, that businesses do when they get bigger, those are not things that are available to artists. So, you know, I've been working for the past year on this new structure called an artist corporation or an A corp, which is like an LLC or an S corp or a C corp, is a legal designation. It's a new type. You have to pass a law to make that happen. We're working on passing a law in a specific US state that will be strategically valuable for artists and this will be a great first place to get started. And it will allow, as an artist, as a creative business, for you to register yourself as an artist corporation. I'm both the creative person and I'm an entrepreneur. It allows you to take in both for-profit and nonprofit money. It allows you to protect your IP, have your work owned within this container of your A Corp. Mm-hmm. It allows you to, if you wish, issue shares, which you could do as collaborators. So if the three of us are partners, equal, equal, great. We all own 1/3 of this. And there's like actual paperwork to prove that. In the event that some financial event happens, it all is clear what's meant to happen. And it can do things like give you access to healthcare, pull together with other A Corps. And it's just creating a very basic form, really taking parts of what exists already and reconfiguring them and saying, this is a special category of work. These are people that create huge amounts of value. These are people that are currently blocked from capitalism. This is a structure that reflects all the different income streams that are the reality of being a creative person, for-profit, nonprofit, royalties, streaming, merch, like all the mess of things that we all deal with. And it recognizes those and says, all of these things together, this has real value. This has equity. This is something that can grow. Wow. And so we have great legal experts writing this with us and making the case to politicians who are very receptive.
Yeah. I mean, for anybody that's watching this on YouTube later, you can see that Michaela and I are just nodding the whole time because it's like, why doesn't this exist? We live in Nashville. We live in Tennessee. The music industry is a $7 billion industry in this state. That is not a small industry. And really, there's not much of this available. We both have LLCs. And I admittedly just set up an LLC last year. I did it to be able to access capitalism for tax purposes, for all of this, to be able to have more capital, to have more legitimacy in the eyes of the system that we live in. And it has blown my mind how many people, be it other musicians and peers or friends that are outside of the music industry, that their response to me setting up an LLC has been kind of like, is that legal? Like, you're doing some shady tax stuff. And I'm like, I have a business. I own and run a business. I can imagine that on top of having to present and grow this idea of an A-Corp legally, there's also a public perception that you're trying to go up against here as well.
Certainly for, you know, if you're a musician or a filmmaker, depending on your practice, like every industry interaction you've had has probably been somewhat adversarial, mm-hmm. you know, whether you realize it or not, you're navigating a gauntlet of needing to protect yourself and your interests. Mm-hmm. And I've been going around the country meeting with artists at every level of their careers and hearing from them and heard too many stories of people of, I signed a deal. It was not a good deal for me. Let me walk you through what it took to get out of that. Or I'm not out of that. And just like horror stories mm-hmm. that a lot of what these artists were wanting to hear in these face-to-face conversations was like, is this actually safe? How do you protect my safety? So much of us are just trying to get to the point where we can get our shot. The people who got that and got their shot are like, yo, that was like, I got done dirty, you know?
Yep. How, mm-hmm.
And so I think those sorts of questions that we have, they come from a scarcity mindset. They come from a mindset of we assume we're being abused by deals that we sign, because we often are. One of the most famous people in this industry said to me that the entire structure of all the labels, studios, publishers, all of it, it all exists to hide from the artist the true value of their work. That is the only reason the system makes sense.
I just got chills.
Yeah, me too.
Because the true value of the artist's work is as intellectual property. That's how we describe it now. But as a renewable, again, financial terms, renewable asset that keeps generating things, will continue to have relevance, staying power, whatever. The entire goal of this system is to own and control those things and to do all sorts of weird deductions as possible to ensure that they're getting 85 cents of every dollar. And that's what the terms say they're supposed to get. They're getting even more than that, of course, mm-hmm. in reality. And that has existed because early days of every industry, these gatekeepers, that was how anything got out into the world. Pre-internet, the line between mainstream and underground was like Grand Canyon chasm difference. You know, it's not mm-hmm. like today where if you're indie or whatever, it doesn't make a big difference. Back then, it made a really big difference. And so they could set these sorts of tolls, right? They could set these rents. And like, what choices an artist have? And because so few people actually were practicing artists, oh, okay, some rich people got less rich than they would have before. A few people got exploited. Like, what's the big problem? Yeah, it mm-hmm. sucks for them. Like, maybe as a society, we wouldn't care that much. But now you have 48% of Americans have a practice. Being a creator is the most desired profession for people under the age of 25. AI is just going to make a lot of what are currently jobs, just input, output, which is ultimately going to make personality, identity, voice, those sorts of qualities where I think we as creative people are especially skilled. I think that just becomes more important. And Mr. Beast Burgers or something, or like maybe an extreme version of this, but like I can imagine a future where A-Corps are competing with C-Corps mm-hmm. for being like, what type of community economy do you want to live in? Like, what's your brand of capitalism? Is it supporting other artists no matter what they do, or is it a more traditional style of old school corporate capitalism? Like, I can see how if we as creative people are placed in the driver's seat, if we have a table of our own, not just a seat at the table, you know, I think the outcomes begin to look quite different. And a part of this does need to come with a lot of education for us as creative people. I mean, I got it through starting a business. Like, I had to learn these skills, and I'd always been terrified of money growing up. To me, it's like money and culture are like opposite ends of the room, and you care about one, you can't care about the other. I find a lot of my friends were raised with a similar sort of ethos and mindset. It doesn't serve you well. It is good to be educated. It is good to know how to handle your business. The world I hope for is one where we as artists and creators and musicians, we're making a better living from our work. We are investing in each other. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the great things of old school Silicon Valley is that when people would make it, they would invest in like the next generation of people. And that's how you create just these massive amounts of wealth over time. It's just, let's just reinvest in each other and let's build out our universe. And that's the path I imagine, you know, where Tyler, the creator, is putting checks in to young artists and helping them put out their first singles and is like not exploiting them the way that, say, a traditional, you know, but was thinking about them as this is a younger version of me.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I think that's the culture that we could create together.
Hey, just a quick pause from this conversation. The Other 22 Hours is an independent production built entirely on the idea that these quiet, honest conversations matter. The best way to support our work is simply to share it. So if you can think of one person who would appreciate this show, please pass it along. And if you haven't yet, please follow our show on your listening platform of choice or subscribe to our channel on YouTube. It's a small action that makes a massive difference for us. Thanks for being here. Let's get back to our conversation.
We are in our late 30s. We met in music school in New York City. We went to the New School. And we've had this path where in our 20s, we went on tour a lot. We played in bars. We partied, all this stuff. And then in our 30s, we're married. We started having children. And Aaron built this recording studio. He shifted from being a touring drummer to being a producer. And we both started shifting our mindset of like, oh, we're building businesses. We are artists and creatives, but we have to get serious, especially bringing children into the world. Like, we have to like pay for daycare and like all this stuff. And I had been releasing records. I had a record deal with the indie label. And around this time of having kids, I started to rethink the structure and started to get mad that I wouldn't have my life's work given to my children, even not even like for a monetary reason. And it's taken me a process. I got out of my deal, and I'm not even sure when this episode is going to air, but it's taken me a whole emotional process to get to the point where I'm going to do a Kickstarter to fund my next record. I want to own everything. Like, I had this idea of, whoa, we could build this whole thing. And the stereotype is pretty true. Not an aging white dude who owns the company, who owns a million masters of albums that people put their blood, sweat, and tears to. We could do this. But the emotional work to get to the point where I believed that I had any power 10 plus years into my career is really difficult. At the end of your TED talk, you say, artists don't need pity, we need power. And I'm so curious how we can convince ourselves to know that we have power, even if we might not feel we have leverage yet, because so much of this business of the music industry is being told, you can't do it alone. You need the gatekeepers, you need a record deal, you need a booking agent. You're not gonna be able to like build anything if you don't have an agent. You need all these other people. So how can we convince ourselves that we have the potential to gain leverage, but that we already have the power even when we don't have the big income, the big following, any of that stuff? Because how do we believe that creating art is meaningful and essential and not a narcissistic luxury?
Well, if I knew that, I would take that pill every day. that last one in particular. Yeah. That's a tough one. Yeah. I want to hear more about your feeling of powerlessness, but just to speak to it just for a little bit. If I look at my emotional experience, like when I was a writer early on, like I would have loved to have written for Rolling Stone or, you know, New York Times or whatever. There's like 20 outlets. I would have done anything to have my name in it, and it never happened. And that to me felt like that's the door that will lead to everything I wanted, and I didn't get it. Now, like if one of those places asked me to write for them, I actually don't know if I would do it, because now I have found a greater source of strength in like peer legitimacy. Maybe it's that the gatekeeper approval people, they are late adopters. They are not original thinkers. For the most part, they're looking for what's already happening. And the sort of value and the sort of approval that matters most to me is like what my peers think. And a lot of the thinking that led to the creation of the Project Meta label that I do now is about how the start of indie record labels or different scenes really began by artists sort of legitimizing each other, almost like a Ponzi scheme of reputation. It's an A-frame. We build a house together through just, we do things with each other. And there's like a collective power that comes out of that. Mm-hmm. So what I think is that we don't need the approval of people from above. They're going to come too late to the party and they're going to be kind of lame. And like, we'll use them if they're useful to us. But I think what's really valuable are just these interdependent networks among people like us, of like fellow artists, fellow people. And I think that is the path to making our own forms of legitimacy, our own types of institutions. We throw our own one-day festival where we build the bill and everyone looks amazing. You know, we all get to be on the Coachella poster. Like, we do those things ourselves, and people are going to like follow. People are going to chase. Like, people don't know what they want. What, you know, it's like we create those things and it brings the energy to us. So I feel like it is not that we could do it on our own, mm-hmm. but it is that we can do it collectively on our own. The internet is like the victory of the losers. in a positive way, where think about like YouTube. YouTube starts, who puts up videos on YouTube? I don't mean this unkindly, but losers, people who can't get on TV or whatever. It's like, who's on YouTube? But you know what? There's a lot more of us than there are people who can get on TV.
Mm-hmm.
And over time, we come to be, as a mass, something even bigger and something that then the people who are legitimate and who before would have looked down on this now are trying to get in the same space because there's been a new system of legitimacy created that bypasses these existing whatever. So I just think that it's not alone, but there is a degree of cooperation and co-alignment that I think we all benefit from. And that mm-hmm. right now is informal in a lot of peer relationships. And it's like, how good a person are you? It's like how good your network, your community is. But I think that is a source of market power, that is a source of creative power, that is a source of emotional confidence. I think those are things that are within our grasp. You know, I personally just went through an experience of being extremely creatively burnt out 4 or 5 years ago for very similar reasons to these things and feeling extremely isolated. And ultimately, in trying to understand that, created a project that produced a very different situation for myself. Now I'm in many such groups and I do my own things, but I'm also probably half my time I'm collaborating with other people on projects, and it's quite nice. But when you say you felt powerless and then you felt powerful, can you talk about ways that would show up or like what you think about, what mm-hmm. moments say you think about when you think of that emotion?
Even when I think about it right now, it feels like my mind is, you know, zinging through examples of how I have felt powerlessness in the music industry. It feels factual. I'm like, no, I don't have any power in this. Like, because I signed an indie record deal in 2019 and put the record out. And so I got financial support and industry like affirmation, the backroom stuff that you're left out of when you don't have the label support of like, we can get this with YouTube. Radio stations will listen to us more to actually listen to your music. And I saw the positive come from that. I saw gaining an audience. I saw radio support, then selling more tickets. I signed with a big time booking agent who books my heroes and then had access. And my experience was that was all well and good, except I didn't own my record. You don't realize the ways that actually can impact you in your real life down the line, because I'm like, well, it's okay that I own my record because maybe half as many people would have heard it if I had owned it and released it myself. But now my vinyl is out of print and the record label will not reprint my vinyl. My operation depends on my vinyl sales when I go and play shows. It's a drop in the bucket for them, so they don't want to reinvest. But it's a portion of my income that I rely on. My agent, when I told him I was pregnant, dropped off, told me how hard it was going to be, stopped answering emails. I didn't get festival bookings and tours. Those are the instances of like, well, where is my power if the person that is able to get me work is no longer interested and that work won't listen to me? When I email them, they're not going to respond. But when my agent emails them, they'll respond. And now that agent is like, you're pregnant. You're not a worthy investment anymore. So those are all of the experiences that I think what happened for me, I eventually was like, fuck it all. I don't care. Because I got to the point where I would rather sit at home. Or honestly, what I think happened, Aaron is a good motivator and a problem solver and reminder of all these things. I went and started playing house concerts. In my earlier life, I would have thought that would look like I wasn't a legit artist. If I was going to play house concerts, I needed to be playing certain clubs and working with certain promoters, you know, all that stuff. But I would go play a house concert and be like, wait, I'm making more money and there's less hands taking from the pie. And these are fans. There are people here. Why does it matter that these people are supporting my music in the living room versus in a club? I'm just going to the source. And that all kind of shifted my mind, that actually kind of re-inspired my earlier ethos when I was just starting out. I used to think of that as a failure.
Totally. I know exactly what you mean. And I wonder if part of it is maybe you needed that experience of you get the label deal, you get that, you're able to be disillusioned to like be able to appreciate it. Because otherwise that might have always seemed like the golden ring.
100%.
I think about this quote from Kurt Cobain all the time, where he talks about how by far his favorite time in Nirvana was the year before Nevermind came out. And they were touring in a van around the country, and they could feel that the music they were making was good and that people loved it, but like no one quite knew yet.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, if I could have just stayed in that place forever, I would have chosen to. And there's such a tendency we have to rush past the early start because we're in a rush to get big. I think of like when you have a birthday party. At the beginning, it's like maybe only your two closest friends are there and you're glad to see them, but you're also like, what if no one comes and you're all stressed and like, you're not appreciating that two of your best friends are there with you right now.
Mm-hmm.
And then eventually, actually, everybody shows up. And when they do, you're like, oh my God, I'm so stressed. I can't even talk to anybody. This is too much. And, you know, and it's like, that's fame. That's a creative career.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard because we have egos, we have expectations. There's so many things that drive us. I ran a tiny label, like digital only label back in the day where I would go to see bands at shows and I would find their CDRs and I'd be like, hey, let me put it online for you. And I'll like get you a Pitchfork review and whatever. And took no ownership. They got all the money. Like it was just because I enjoyed doing it. Several of those bands went on to get courted. And one band, the Rural Alberta Advantage, who still play today, great band. They'd made like 60 grand selling their first EP like online with me. And labels were courting them, like Sub Pop, Saddle Creek, all these things. We had a South by Southwest experience where they played their 10 shows. You know, I'm there with them the whole time. All the labels are there. It's the whole deal. And we were looking through these deals together, and it was clear that they were going to make less money on all these deals than they were with me. But what the three of them spoke about was signing a deal would say to their parents or their spouses, we're legit.
Mm-hmm.
We have made it. Mm-hmm. And for them at that moment, having been making music forever and satisfying that emotional need, getting over that hurdle was the most important thing. And I thought they were totally right to do so. I saw it. I absolutely saw it and like understood that. There's a degree of calmness that gives us that we maybe find is temporary. It's temporary.
Mm-hmm.
But like, I would love for everyone to be able to have that part of our ego satisfied enough to just let us appreciate what we actually have. Because often, I think almost always we have more than we realize, and that what we believe will be our salvation is just another gate. And it probably has more trade-offs than we realize. But it's hard living in a culture and an information environment where you're constantly comparing yourself. And of course, we all have such dreams for what we do. Why else would we be here? We're really good at tying ourselves in knots, I think.
Funding is the big thing as well. Legitimacy and the connections, but funding. And because signing a record deal is a different kind of debt versus if I took out a loan or racked up some credit card debt to support what I need to like put a record out or did a Kickstarter. And that's a whole other thing. Also having the emotional stance to believe that you are worthy enough to ask people and it's not embarrassing to do a Kickstarter. But a record label, we don't see that in the same way because they're not going to come collecting from us. But there's all this money spent on my account that also I don't even know what's spent a lot of times. What publicist is taking someone out to a fancy dinner and that's charged to my account. And that's that much more money that needs to be recouped before I see a percentage of the net profit. So you just kind of can put it away. So that's an interesting part of like, how can artists create more financial freedom and not get tied up into these very veiled deals that also a lot of artists don't share deals with each other.
Oh, for sure.
I had a friend send me her record contract because she was like, I believe we need to know this stuff. And then all of a sudden we're revealing like, oh, wait, you just did like a 7-year license? What? I feel like a dumbass because I signed an in perpetuity ownership and then having to grapple with that. Like, well, maybe I wouldn't have signed that if we knew more culturally with each other.
For sure. I was at a dinner to A-list fine artists represented by the same gallery. They just start talking about their structures or the deal. They discover they had wildly different financial arrangement, everything. And we're just flabbergasted by that. They could not believe it. We as artists, creative people, enter these arrangements at a real disadvantage. You know, they can always pass on you and pick the next person. They make sure you know, like all of these things are tilted in very specific ways. You know, I think that everyone is still going to have their own self-interests in these situations. The world I envision with an A-Corp would be, say, in that instance, if you had had an artist corporation for yourself and you're like, great, this A-Corp represents like my studio practice, we'll make an A-Corp to represent this new record. You can invest what you would have done in advance. You invest to pay for the production of that from that point on. I own 70% of the record. You own 30% because that's what we negotiated in this. And this just exists in perpetuity. And this is how we'll structure things. But it allows for the idea of there to be not like you are extracting your post-recoup earnings, but that there is a shared upside and a project that you are co-creating and like co-investing in together. Record labels are like banks for musicians. Movie studios are banks for filmmakers. Like a lot of their power does come from money and does come from the terms they extract as a result of that. I think in an A-Corp world, my hot idea is that I think there's an A-Corp bank. Like I think there absolutely needs to be a bank that is loaning money to artists at like the right terms. You know, it's like our bank, a co-op bank that's ours, a credit union sort of thing that is filling those gaps, a thing that's absolutely going to happen. And, you know, within what we made at Metalabel, like advances, recoups are such great tools. So we built that system so that anyone could use it. So that like us as a group of people, if we're going to help you put out your record, we can advance you $5,000 and that money comes back automatically through sales and it's fully transparent. There's no weird accounting. You click some buttons on a website, you know, you could see your balance. But like those instruments, those tools are useful in themselves and they don't just have to come from the entities who have done it in the past. And there's even a world in which we can be doing it for each other, I think, at maybe not the same scale as, you know, a giant record or something, but you can get pretty far.
Yeah. The more I hear you talk about A-Corps, and again, just relating it to the music industry that we know, I'm hearing a lot of parallels, in essence, to like the union, to collective bargaining, strength in numbers, but more capital facing rather than being our advocate to the people that are the gatekeepers to capitalism. So I'm interested to hear your take on then this collective push and ownership and autonomy. How does that then deal with in this decade, the gatekeepers to the public being Spotify, Apple, YouTube, that actually get our art out there?
I confess to not having a super insightful take on like streaming media, how that looks differently. I'm not sure, but I do think that we have to keep making the case and we have to keep creating new and interesting reasons for people to directly support and engage with artists. Ultimately, a little bit, we have to compete with the existing platforms who maybe offer convenience in exchange for meaning. And so we have to offer meaning and maybe it has a price tag and we make it as convenient as we can, but like it's something different. Yeah, we do still face the distribution challenges of we're still moving through these larger systems. I just have this faith that as we begin to build more cultural capital and energy together, which I think is what's been happening online the past 5 years, post-COVID especially, that we are maturing as a group, that the things people are doing are becoming more and more like advanced and innovative. And I don't know, I think we are breaking new ground and that a world in which a group of artists operating in a group chat make projects that generate a lot of financial success and become a model that others can follow. I just think that we're capable of creating those things. I look at what's happened through Metalabel, and I think we've been a good example of fans will pay directly for things. You know, we've had 25,000 collectors have bought a piece of a work on Metalabel in the past year, like $650,000 worth of transactions. And a lot of my writing and experimenting the last few years has been trying to release work in ways that are not just fitting into platform molds. Like last year, I released a kind of a multimedia essay as a limited edition zip file that like made several thousand dollars. You know, it's just so weird. People had to try. I think that the Spotify's, the YouTube's, the gatekeepers, those are like massive channels we all have to move through. But I think we continue to be the innovators. We continue to be the people that are coming up with things. Like we can create new lanes somehow.
I think by having these conversations and, you know, by people like yourself that go out and there are TED Talks and you share these ideas, because I think amongst artists and creators, this is kind of just like a, oh, duh. But these gatekeepers like Spotify, YouTube, Apple, et cetera, like it is essential to their own survival to keep the illusion that they are the only ones that can help us. They're the only ones that offer us this path. And so they spend millions of dollars towards us, you know, like on a business to business level to keep us thinking that that is the only path. Because as soon as we start having these conversations and start like realizing that our prison only has three walls and we can just turn around and walk out, then all of a sudden we have the power.
I know there are some legal limitations to collective bargaining among musicians for specific reasons of like a jukebox law or something. Someone mentioned this to me before. But like, certainly in a world of A-Corps, something like a joint musician boycott of a platform is actually easier to imagine, because it's not about an individual artist making a choice. It's like, hey, as a business unit, we're all deciding to make this choice because we believe that these terms still work for us and we're working for this goal. And like, the difference of the B2B customer being an individual who they know has no say versus the B2B being a client of which they have to be quite anxious about what they think, the same way they are as the major labels, that definitely creates a very different dynamic. Right now, corporations having larger amassed accumulations of power and artists being little vulnerable nodes, you know, that's just going to keep being the bulldozer against the field of daffodils or whatever. It's just hard for us to succeed. But if we show up in a form that they have to respect, that has real power, that works the way the rest of the world works, you know, I'm inclined to think that there are different outcomes that can happen.
I do feel like there is desire for change brewing. There's lots of artists, I mean, even Taylor Swift talking about master ownership and different bands taking their music off of Spotify.
Or even somebody like Evan Hohner, I'm not sure if you know who, he's a younger artist kind of in the Americana songwriter scene, who he's actually the youngest artist we've had on here because we like to have people that have had both the ups and downs. But he became TikTok famous and was able to convert that into live audiences. He got 7-figure label offers from every label in Nashville. And that's confirmed by a friend of ours who is a VP of A&R at one of these labels. He's like, yep, we all offered him 7 figures plus. And he turned it down. He was just like, I'm already making this money. You want me because I'm doing this. And he started his own label called Cloverdale to help other artists.
Which is similar to what you were talking about, like a collective. They aren't like a business structure that's offering a large advance, but they're collaborating together. So they're then like sharing and spreading the word of each other's music by being featured on each other's songs and feeding the algorithm. So it's like, I see the change happening. There's so many more. I mean, we're about to interview a band that's like headlining Madison Square Garden and Hollywood Bowl, and their press release is all about how they are independent now and they are not within the label structure. But the challenge is also like all of the tools that we use to communicate, to find out about each other, like the ways and I found out about you was Instagram. I think about this all the time. I'm just like, every mode, my iPhone to even like talk to people, it feels like every single channel is run by an evil corporate overlord. I'm like, what do we do?
I don't know what to do about that. There's a book, All the King's Men, Robert Penn Warren. It won the Pulitzer Prize in the 1920s. And it's like a fictionalized account of Huey Long, who's the governor of Louisiana. So he's like a crooked boss type of politician, a lot of graft, a lot of doing things. And there's this incorruptible doctor that he's just trying to get to. And he says to him, hey, I'm going to build you the world's best hospital here in wherever it is, this tiny town. You're going to have the world's best hospital. Just take the money. And the doctor's like, no, I will never take your money. And the Huey Long character says, the world is made up of shit. And it's the job of some people to turn shit into something good. I've come here with shit. I'm offering you shit. And you are refusing the offer to turn it into something good. That is like what, you know, the universe doesn't like, something like that. And I wouldn't take in the money if I'm the doctor. I'm stubborn in that way and those sorts of values. But I think about that idea of, you know, what does it mean to try to make something that's shit and to make it something that does truly serve what we wish? And I think that's kind of what's incumbent on us now of like, we have to enter these spaces. I try not to, but I have to. And I need to use it for my own reasons. And I need to use it for my own values. And I have to be careful because these systems are more powerful than me. And I know what they do to me. But how do I feel like I'm using them more than they are using me? Which might be foolish, but I have like my inner core of the people I'm planning projects with. And we have our group chats and we have our workspaces. And then every now and then we venture into the outside world with a release. You know, it's like, all right, we're get our coats on, you know, let's go. Everyone get ready. And then you go out together into the world. Whenever at Metalabel we put out a project, I always write in our chat, asterisk holding hands, like we're all holding hands as we do something. So you're not alone. Mm-hmm. So you go out in public, you put your thing, you all astroturf plus one each other, you know, we're all triangulating our message. And You hope it goes well. Probably you always end up slightly disappointed because we dream big, which is great. Mm-hmm. We shouldn't judge ourselves against our dreams, nor should we discount our dreams, you know? And then we get to do it again. There's a line from Virgil Abloh in one of his books where he says, "Looking back, the one thing I realized was that no work was better than the chance to make a new one." That's the infinite game of art. You know, it's not a finite game with winning or losing. It's just continuing to do it. My father not getting the record deal he wanted, but still playing music all the time, playing music to this day. The best guitar player he's ever been today, you know, at age 75. That is winning. He loves music as much as he ever has. But culture doesn't say it like that. It doesn't feel like that. But, you know, when I was growing up, I probably had like 70 peers who I thought of as like, I'm in competition with these people. And I lost for many of those years. Like, I was like, whatever, I just had the weirdest name. But then over time, it's just, well, who loves it and is still doing it? And that's really what matters. So I think that those cycles of being with my people, my friends, being in my rehearsal space, making things together, enjoying being dazzled by what's possible, the things that happen that you don't know are going to happen. You venture into public. You really, really hope this is the one everyone gets exactly the way, you know, probably does more than you think, but you can't take the compliment, you know, whatever. And we repeat, as long as we could support ourselves doing it, that is a great life. You talk about the battle of it not feeling like whatever, just ego. These are the places I go with that. Let me just be with other people. Let's just let it be fun. And then I'll get to do it again.
Yeah, I love that.
Yeah, that's so beautiful. It's a great kind of closure to our conversation. We like to ask one kind of final question, which in a sense to me kind of sits solidly in the realm of bentoism, which I know we didn't get into. We'll put a link to it in our show notes because it's something that really resonates with me, and I hope we get a chance to talk about that more at a future time. But it's a question of something that somebody has said to you along the way that continues to resonate and inspire you going forward in the work that you do.
There's so many, I don't even know where to start. I'm just going to go with the first clear one that came to mind.
Perfect.
Which is something I read, not something I specifically sold, but there's a essay by C.S. Lewis called The Inner Ring. And he talks about how in our life as a writer or as an artist of any type, we spend all of our days thinking about and longing for this inner ring of the people most in the know, the people at the top of whatever our practice or profession is, and that we make our choices thinking, what will the inner ring want from us and how do we get in? And everything we do is aspiring to do that. But then one day, maybe we arrive in this inner ring and we discover a couple of things. Number one, we discover that these are not the people we thought they were, that it is political. It is not for reasons of truth and beauty like we thought. It is for all sorts of other reasons that are not what we wish. And we also find that for that inner ring, there's an even farther inner ring that they all aspire to and that they look to. Within that inner ring, there's another and so on. And he says, the quest for the inner ring will break our hearts until we break it. And the way we break it is to stop aspiring for the inner ring and instead to aspire for the only thing that matters, and that is to be a master craftsperson in whatever we do. And as a craftsperson, your name will not be celebrated. Your name will not be known except by the other craftspeople who know how quality work is made. And if you do this for long enough, you find yourself in something that looks like an inner ring to the outside, but is in actuality something different. You will find yourself in a group of friends, all people who appreciate the work, who know what it is to make it, and are there to do it for the right reasons. And you discover that is the only ring that really matters. The quest for the inner ring will break our hearts until we break it. I have to tell myself that all the time, because those are the voices of comparison. Those are the voices that discount the things that are unique about us that look wrong from another angle. And we often look at ourselves in the least charitable light. Similarly, there's a Jimmy Buffett line I always think about. He said, they used to tell me I was uncategorizable and now they tell me I'm a category. Same vibe. And so there is just a degree of, you could call it stubbornness. You know, you could call it being insane. Like there's a lot of things that you can call it. But I think the people who, you know how to find their voice, know how to be confident in it, know how to not run from it. We are all capable of that. And a lot of it is just about how generous we are with ourselves. But yeah, the inner ring, beware the inner ring. And that's why I do think about peers, but these are not the people on top. The peers I think about are people like, who do I respect? You know, and like, yeah, I want to be in a place of mutual respect with people I see as being in integrity. And I want to imagine they would look at my actions and think I respect the way that person, you know, that to me is, if I'm orienting towards that, I think I'm probably doing okay.
That was really beautiful. I honestly felt like crying.
I was like, I got my reading assignment for this evening.
This whole conversation feels really grounding in a purposeful life, while also you are actively trying to create tangible ways to help people live that purposeful life, which is really incredible. We live in the society we live in, so we need things to survive. And sometimes I think the way of the artist is like wishing we didn't have to. And I love that what I'm hearing from you is just like such a deeper regard for one while prioritizing the essential need for the other, not putting your head in the sand and wanting to really serve and help communally, which is incredible.
Yeah. And I should mention, like, all of these projects are with so many people. Like, I have amazing collaborators and all of these things that make it not only possible, but fun. And, you know, being a part of a conspiracy, a plot with a group of people you love and respect, I mean, what's more fun? So, yeah, I mean, I think there's many moments of doubt. It's constant doubt. You step back and I think, as I hope you do, you feel grateful for the commitment that you've been able to make in your life.
Man, beautiful.
Yancy, thank you so much for making time this morning to sit with us and to just share your viewpoints and your experience and your wisdom. It's been incredibly enlightening.
Yeah.
So grateful. I'll come down to Nashville. Let's hang out.
Yes, please. I'm sure I'll hit you up later and be like, can we have you on just to talk about Bentoism? So we'll definitely be in touch. Thank you so much.
Thank you both.
We know your time is valuable and we're grateful you chose to spend this hour with us.
If this conversation resonated with you, know that it is just one of many. We have an archive of over 140 conversations, so if you're looking for where to go to next, you can find curated playlists by topic on our YouTube channel or simply scroll back in this feed to find our conversations with Roseanne Cash, New York Times bestselling author Maggie Smith, Lucius, J.D. McPherson, and many others.
This show is produced by me, Aaron Schaefer-Bates, with help from Michaela Ann. All the music you hear is written, performed, and produced by me as well.
Our show is edited and mixed by Leland Holden at Podpunch, and we are proud members of the Bluegrass Situation Podcast Network.
Thanks for being here. We'll see you next time.